It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in Wisconsin Life, we'll learn about Sister Thea Bowman, a Franciscan nun who's nationally recognized for introducing African-American culture, song, and ritual into the Catholic liturgy.
First, we're talking about the fate of people wrongfully convicted in Wisconsin. In 2004, Congress recommended a standard compensation for those exonerated of $50,000 for each year spent behind bars and $100,000 a year for time spent on death row. But a Gannett, Wisconsin media investigation found that people wrongfully convicted in Wisconsin get only a fraction of that amount and only under certain circumstances.
Shereen Seward is here with us now to talk about that investigation. She's an investigative reporter for Gannett, Wisconsin media. Shereen, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So how does compensation work for exonerees, people who have been ruled innocent of the crimes they spent time in prison for? How does that work here in the state?
Well, it's very, very difficult. They face a very long uphill battle. They have to file a complaint with the claims board. And the way it's set up here in Wisconsin, they have to provide clear, convincing evidence that they are innocent. Usually that means a DNA, some kind of DNA or other physical evidence. In the story of Mario Vasquez, there was no DNA, and actually the improper forensics is only a fraction of the causes of wrongful conviction. So and that alone makes it very, very difficult.
So it's a high bar, I guess the idea being, no, this isn't just a technicality that got the decision reversed. We want absolute compelling proof that this person was innocent before we compensate them.
Yes, but if you follow these stories, you can see that, indeed, the bar is set very high. And for these people, they were not released on a technicality. They had a long legal battle, and were finally able to say, hey, I didn't do this thing, I'm free. And then they get out and they face a whole new battle to rebuild their lives. I mean, the punishment continues so far long after they are released. It's just really too bad.
And your piece points out that people who were properly convicted when they get out of prison might get more, not financial assistance, but more things like job training than that person who was wrongfully convicted and released.
Absolutely. People who are exonerated in the state are in a worse situation than somebody who's actually committed a crime. And that alone just speaks volumes about what is wrong here. I mean, these people get out and they don't have any money. They don't have any job training. They've often lost decades of their lives. They've lost their families. Many don't have support from family and friends or jobs to return to, certainly. And they've often been convicted of terrible, terrible crimes. When they're exonerated, they don't get anything and unless they choose to file a federal lawsuit, which can take years to work through and is also very, very difficult.
Talking to Shereen Seward with Gannett, Wisconsin Media about wrongful convictions here in Wisconsin. And you mentioned Mario Vasquez. You focus on him in this piece a lot, wrongfully convicted. How long did he spend in prison? What was life for him like after he came out?
Mario spent 17 years of a 20-year sentence. He could have gotten out earlier. He had been convicted of sexually assaulting a 4-year-old child. In January, a judge ordered a new trial for Mario based on new evidence, and he was a free man. But he is lucky. He has the family support. He has the love of very many people. But still, it has been very difficult for him to rebuild his life as well. And of course, he has spent 17 years behind bars. He hasn't been able to contribute to Social Security. He hasn't been earning in any of those years. He would be in a much, much different situation. In addition, he could have gotten out earlier had he admitted that he had done this thing and agreed to go through sex offender counseling. And he refused to do that. He maintained his innocence. And because of that, ironically, he spent a longer amount of time in prison than he would have.
I understand there's a legislative effort to change the compensation system for people in Mario Vasquez's position. Mm-hmm. What would happen?
What would happen. The legislation proposes to bump up that level of compensation from $5,000 per year to the recommended $50,000 per year level. There would also be counseling, transportation, health care, and temporary housing, some job services for these folks. This bill has been introduced before. It has repeatedly failed to pass. It will be introduced again this fall. And this law in Wisconsin hasn't been updated in almost 30 years. So that tells you how long it's been before anybody has really taken a serious look at making a change.
And you cite bipartisan support for a change in your piece.
Yes, actually, they all seem very optimistic that this has a chance this time around. So we'll be following that very, very carefully, and watching it as it's introduced and voted on.
And obviously, the state, everyone would have an interest in not wrongfully convicting people, just A, because they have to go through that for no reason, and B, because the actual perpetrators then don't get caught. What kind of reforms are state police and prosecutors looking at to make sure the wrong people don't end up in prison?
Well, certainly nobody wants to get it wrong. I mean, the police do a great job. Prosecutors do a wonderful job. They all believe in what they're doing, and nobody wants to get it right more than they do. There have been some reforms that have happened in Wisconsin. They've started to record all police interviews. They've allowed post-conviction DNA testing. Some evidence preservation efforts have been increased, and some eyewitness identification reform as well. But the compensation piece is really not there. And as you said, it is a tragedy on many levels. In Mario's case, according to court records, the real perpetrator quite possibly continued to assault this victim for years. So there are many people that are affected by wrongful convictions, and of course, everybody wants to do what they can to eliminate them.
Now, how many exonerations do we know about in recent Wisconsin history?
There have been 40. There have been 40 in the last 25 years. The majority of them have been in the last 10. I'd like to say, though, that the Wisconsin Innocence Project has a waiting list of more than 250 cases that they've already vetted and feel have a valid case that could be fought. It can often take 7 or 8 years for the Innocence Project to get to their cases. They just don't have the funds or the manpower necessary to take a look at those cases. So quite possibly there are many more Marios out there.
And one of the things that stood out in Mario Vasquez's wrongful conviction was his representation, his defense attorney, someone who was later disbarred, I think, or removed from the courts.
Yes, he had over 100 instances of misconduct and was eventually disbarred.
And so the idea there, maybe this defendant and others in similar cases didn't get the full representation that might have gotten them out of being wrongfully convicted in the first place.
That can happen. The top cause of wrongful conviction is eyewitness misidentification. Improper forensics plays another part. Most recently, we've learned about some faulty bite mark analysis that's been called under fire. False confessions, you would be surprised, but nearly 30% are actually people who confess to crimes they didn't commit because they feel they have no other choice and they can at least get a lenient sentence. And then informants are the fourth major key there, informants who are telling tall tales. So.
And can you leave us by telling us where Mario Vasquez is now, this former inmate, wrongfully convicted, just exonerated, given that he's getting no compensation, basically? What is his life like today?
Is living with his wife, who he actually divorced while he was in prison, and they have since reconciled. He's getting to know his son again, who was 3 when he went to prison and is now 20 years old. He's been working in a restaurant that a family member owns and just working on rebuilding his life and learning about the world today, which is a very different place from the one he left.
Shereen, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Shereen Seward, investigative reporter for Gannett, Wisconsin Media, with us to talk about her new report on wrongful convictions here in Wisconsin. Since August 1st, 1874, the Sisters of the Perpetual Adoration have been constantly praying in La Crosse. The order's first and so far only African-American Franciscan sister, Thea Bowman, passed away 25 years ago. This year, her fellow nuns, former students, and friends are remembering a woman who fought for civil rights and used music to enrich her faith. Maureen McCollum introduces us to this remarkable Wisconsin woman.
What does it mean to be black in the church and society?
For Sister Thea Bowman, it meant being an educator, a preacher, a scholar, a singer, a woman devoted to God, all while being charming and incredibly charismatic. Sister Thea was born a Protestant in Mississippi in 1937, the granddaughter of slaves. She boldly told her parents at age 12 that she wanted to convert to Catholicism. At 15, she moved north to La Crosse to attend St. Rose Convent and study at what is known today as Viterbo University. As a Franciscan Sister of Perpetual Adoration, she dedicated her life to civil rights. She worked to empower the black community while educating others about African Americans' history and experience.
What does it mean to be black and Catholic? It means that I bring myself, my black self, all that I am, all that I have, all that I hope to become. I bring my whole history, my traditions, my experience, my culture, my African-American song and dance and gesture and movement and teaching and preaching and healing and responsibility as gift to the church.
Sister Thea brought songs to the Catholic Church that were ingrained in her roots. She helped create the first hymnal that included gospel music. These songs were more than praise. She sang them to get her point across.
We shall overcome. Y'all get up. Oh, we shall overcome.
In the late 1950s, Sister Thea began teaching at a Catholic elementary school in La Crosse, a rare position for an African-American woman at that time. She spent years moving around the world and returned to La Crosse in the early 70s to chair the English department at Viterbo. Dr. Deborah Pembleton was a former student of Sister Thea's in Mississippi during the late 60s and is now a professor in Minnesota. She and her friends were inspired by the nun from their hometown to leave their small community. Pembleton says every time Sister Thea visited her school, her classmates felt empowered.
We were given strict instructions by the sisters, of course, to be on our best behavior when she came. And when she came, you wouldn't necessarily say that she was on her best behavior. Because she would be rollicking with laughter. I mean, her whole body would just embrace the music.
Not only did Sister Thea work to improve life for African Americans in the Catholic Church, but she brought people of all cultures together.
I can introduce my black friends to my Hispanic friends, to my Anglo friends, to my Asian friends, to my native friends. I can be the bridge over troubled water. I can take you by the hand and take you with me into the black community. I can walk with you into your community. I don't walk as a stranger. I walk as your sister.
Sister Thea Bowman died of cancer in 1990 at age 52. Many people will say she was a saint, but she's not an official one in the eyes of the Catholic Church. For years, there's been casual chatter about canonizing Sister Thea, but no group has officially pursued the idea.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Joining us now to talk more about the life of Sister Thea Bowman is Sister Charlene Smith. She's the author of Thea's song, The Life of Thea Bowman. Sister Charlene, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So this young African-American nun from Mississippi moves to Wisconsin, shakes things up. It sounds like a movie script almost. What do we know about how she was received by the local community and how she saw them?
Well, she was received, as you would imagine, back in 1953. In La Crosse, Wisconsin, it was mostly Germanic white people and Irish people. There were two or three African Americans living here. When she decided to come to La Crosse to be a religious sister, her parents were very opposed to that. In fact, they said, you can't go. They were more interested in her having, in their having grandchildren. So Thea began a fast, and when her parents realized that she was really serious about it, they relented. But her father said, why don't you go to New Orleans and join an African-American group of religious women? And Thea said no, she was more interested. She wanted to be a Franciscan Sister of Perpetual Adoration, because she had been taught by them during her grade school and early high school years. So she went north. And it was severe culture shock, but she masked that. She did everything that she could to submerge her own black culture because she wanted to be the very best sister she could be, and she was. She went through her formative years very successfully. She came to the convent in 1953, and I came in 1954, and I remember the first time I saw her. It, at that time, it was the custom of the religious sisters to have some spiritual reading done while they were enjoying their evening meal. And I thought to myself, well, isn't that interesting? The nuns are having blacks doing their reading. I found out very quickly that the nuns did not have blacks doing their reading. It was Bertha Bowman who was ready to become a Franciscan sister, just like I wanted to be. We both wanted to be Franciscans, we both wanted to major in English, and we both wanted to teach, and we did that.
Now, you said that initially she submerged her African-American culture in her religious life, but obviously that's not the end of the story, because she ended up bringing it to the nuns and the community at large. So what changed? When did she turn the corner?
You're very perceptive, Veronica. What happened was the Franciscans realized that she was a gifted woman, and so they educated her all the way through master's degree and PhD. They sent her to the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., and for the first time in her life, Sister Thea saw very successful professional African-Americans in all walks of life. They were in government, they were in academia, they were in business, and she thought, well, isn't that interesting? Blacks can be successful. I'm black. I can be as successful as they are by being my own African-American self. And so she, from that time on, she gloried in her own culture. And as you said in the introduction, she shared her culture with everybody she met. She was a very successful college teacher at what is now the Turbo University. In 1978, she went back to Canton, Mississippi, because her parents were aging and she wanted to help take care of them. And while she was there, the bishop of the Diocese of Jackson asked her to head a new office called Intercultural Awareness, and he wanted her to go throughout the state of Mississippi and share the African-American culture in the Catholic Church. As she did that, she was very successful. Wherever she went, she sang, and she preached her African-American style of liturgy. And she not only did it in Mississippi, she went to Alabama and Louisiana and Texas and South Carolina and all points in the United States. And she was very instrumental in getting African-American culture into the Catholic liturgy.
And you mentioned, yeah, her singing. I don't think of gospel music usually associated with the Catholic Church. Did her parishioners, her students, take to that?
Oh, they certainly did. We all do. Too bad you weren't here on March 30th in La Crosse, Wisconsin, at our chapel. We had an African-American priest who had been one of Thea's students, and we had the Viterbo Concert College Choir singing African songs, and the whole church erupted in song and dance and clapping along with that old-time religion. It was really very wonderful. Thea was a very gifted person, and she was an outstanding singer. I often thought as I sat beside her in chapel or other places while there was singing going on, here I am sitting next to somebody who has the voice of an opera star. And I remember when she went back to Mississippi, she began to travel over the United States, and at that time I was in Washington, D.C. myself, working on an international religious office. And I remember one evening she was in town to do a speech, and we had been invited to the hotel before dinner, and we were early, so we went to the lounge, and there was a piano player from Argentina playing selections from Porgy and Bess, and she got up and she began to sing Summertime. Mm. And I remember saying to the people sitting beside me, I never saw that woman before in my life. But after she finished, she got a standing ovation. So, of course, I said, well, yeah, that's Omen.
We heard in the piece that there are those who call her a saint. Is that a figure of speech, or are there people who associate miracles with her?
Well, there are some people who associate miracles with her. It's true. We have not furthered her cause for canonization in our community because we are of the opinion, and a lot of people agree with us, that Sister Thea would rather have us spend all the money that takes for canonization to be spent on education, especially on education of the African-American students. However, the African-American black Catholics have proclaimed her a saint by proclamation, unofficially, of course, but a lot of people consider her to be very saintly. And she was my good friend, and I'm just amazed that I knew somebody that people call saintly.
Sister Charlene, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Sister Charlene Smith, the author of Thea's Song, The Life of Thea Bowman.
As more and more companies adapt to an increasingly digital world, there's an increasing need across the nation for information technology workers, people like web page designers, software writers, network specialists, and more.
But here in Wisconsin, there are parts of the state that are having a hard time keeping up. Our next guest looked at the IT talent shortage in central Wisconsin, something one college president said is reaching a crisis state. The state's universities and technical colleges are working to close the gap, but there are still challenges to overcome.
Joining us now is Dave Daly. He's a longtime journalist. He recently explored this issue for the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute. Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yep, good to be with you.
So this shortage of IT workers in central Wisconsin, as we mentioned, a college president said we're reaching a crisis stage. So what's that looking like? What's that crisis looking like?
The bottom line is the school system, high schools and colleges, are not graduating enough people interested in the IT field to fill this huge growing demand for IT workers, and educators and business types in central Wisconsin say that that is causing some problems. They are bumping into each other. Renaissance Learning is a big software developer. They develop software for learning programs in schools, and their officials say that they bump into recruiters from other central Wisconsin software companies trying to basically recruit the same graduates that they're trying to recruit. And the bottom line is the colleges and the technical colleges, the four-year colleges and the two-year technical colleges at this point are not graduating enough IT graduates to fill this growing demand.
And you mentioned software developers specifically, but I imagine this problem spreads to all the businesses that need an IT department, no matter what line of work or product they're in.
Yes, educators make it clear that this is the 21st century economy, and anything you can think of, any business, any occupation, is going to need people in the information technology field. Web page designers, people that write code for software, people that design security system to keep out the hackers. Lori Wires is the president of North Central Technical College in Wausau. And she makes the point that in the 21st century, as we go forward, we're going to reach a point where 60% of the jobs are going to be in the technical field. She's a very firm advocate of the need to do more to attract high school students into the IT field, to educate more high school teachers on how to teach IT classes in high school, and to make IT credits if you're in a two-year technical college and want to go on to a four-year college after you get that two-year associate degree. She's arguing that we need educators need to make it easier for those credits to transfer to the four-year college. She also makes it a point about the number of students they get that are basically students with BA and BS degrees from four-year colleges that have degrees in things like history, can't find a job, come back to school and go to an IT college and learn an IT trade that can land them a pretty good paying job as they walk out the door. She calls them the tech college's graduate students, and she says about 20% of their students fit that category.
Talking with journalist Dave Daly about a piece he wrote for the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute saying, hey, there's an IT information technology talent shortage in central Wisconsin, not just there, elsewhere too. Critical jobs for the future, maybe a drag on the economy. Want to hear from you, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Are you part of this equation as an employer, as an IT worker, as an educator, maybe at a technical college or high school? Where do you see the problems and where do you see solutions? Dave, I mentioned startups and entrepreneurship there. I've seen the case made that if we want to be the next Silicon Valley in Wisconsin, maybe we'll never get there, but the idea that we need lots of these types of employees out there, do you see this as a drag on business creation in the state, this shortage?
Well, I think the connection can be made. We have companies in Wisconsin, like Epic out of Verona, Wisconsin, a suburb of Madison. They employ as many as 8,000 workers. They develop software for the health, for hospitals and healthcare related industries. Just think of how big healthcare is in the country right now. Almost everything, as you pointed out, is becoming digitized, which means you are going to. There's only going to be a continuing growing need for people in that IT field. Just in central Wisconsin, you have Skyward, a big education software company in Stevens Point. They're building a $30 million headquarters, world headquarters, that will open in December. Right now, they have 400 workers across the U.S. Once they open their new world headquarters in Stevens Point, they expect to employ as many as 900 workers in Wisconsin alone. So it's not just central Wisconsin, as some of these educators and business types point out. It's across the state and across the country. Lori Wires, the president of North Central Technical College, used the phrase, it's a national issue.
So let's get into what solutions are out there and stay with technical colleges for a moment. What kind of changes are they making, especially in the central Wisconsin area, to try to keep up with the need for IT workers?
North Central College and the other 15 technical colleges in the state are working to establish what they call IT academies in the high schools. The IT academies have a two-prong focus. Teach high school and junior high school students IT courses that can later actually transfer the credit once they actually graduate from high school and go on to an IT college. Teach them some of these IT courses at the basic level that can be transferred once they go on to that two-year college, and also train high school teachers in how to teach IT courses. Dr. Wires, for example, and other technical college educators say there needs to be more of a focus in the high schools to get these students into that pipeline, to get them attracted to the IT field. Dr. Wires is very, very passionate about the fact that there is a perception, a misperception in her mind out there about the old school image of the tech school as a place for learning how to weld or learning how to repair a car. Her bottom line is right now these IT courses are cutting edge for them as far as attracting students. And students can walk out of those IT colleges after 2 years and land a pretty good paying job, she argues, 50, 60, 70, 80,000 a year. With only a two-year degree, and both business and colleges, both the four-year and two-year colleges, need to make it clear to high school students there is a good career in the IT field.
And that's the technical colleges. Is there a role for the UW system? Are they trying to tackle this?
It seems to be. I really can't speak to it directly, but I can say this. The technical colleges seem to be taking the lead on this, although, for example, UW-Stevens Point is scrambling to hire more faculty to teach IT courses. They can't even hire enough faculty, much less graduate enough IT graduates to fill the need. So some of the four-year colleges are seeing this and are moving to meet the need.
So one concern is the whole brain drain concept that if Central Wisconsin trains IT graduates, they might come to Madison or Verona and work for Epic or go to Milwaukee. Or if Wisconsin trains these students, they might go to Chicago or the Twin Cities or a coast. Is part of the solution here trying to keep those students here in Wisconsin getting jobs here?
That is part of it. The chancellor at UW-Stevens Point, Bernie Patterson, makes the point that they had the same problem in the medical field, and he points out that if you recruit students from your area, from the normal area that, say, Stevens Point draws for students, if you recruit them from that area, that seems to be a very good strategy for keeping them in the area once they graduate with that advanced degree or that IT degree that can help them get a job. And clearly, if you grow up in a certain area, I think it's common sense that you probably have a better chance of keeping those people in that area once they graduate. But it's very true, Chicago, Milwaukee, Minneapolis, Madison, that's a draw for a lot of these young millennials, that the urban lifestyle is an attraction, the restaurants, theater, movies, all the nightlife is an attraction, and this is what small towns and small cities in central Wisconsin have to compete with. Brian Hoover is the president of a young professionals group out of Wausau, and his bottom line is Wausau, for example, is doing more to develop its downtown, putting in bike and walking paths, putting in more green space. These are things that attract millennials, that young professionals, Brian says. And companies that work to make the job more attractive to the young professionals. Casual dress code, flexible hours, on-site health care, if they're big enough. Those are the companies that have a better chance of keeping these IT workers, young professionals, millennials. You can use whatever term you want.
We're talking with Dave Daly about the IT talent shortage in central Wisconsin and beyond. You can join in with your questions and your experiences at 800-642-1234.
If you're a business owner, are you having a hard time filling your IT positions? If you currently work in the field, what is it that drew you to that work? And maybe if you're a student who's working towards a degree in IT, what would convince you to take a job in Wisconsin when you graduate? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with journalist Dave Daly. In a recent piece for the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute, he looked into the IT talent shortage in central Wisconsin and beyond. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234.
Are you part of this story of computer workers, information technology staff, maybe as a business owner? Are you having trouble hiring the talent you need, or are you in this field? What do the job prospects look like? Why do you work where you work and live where you live? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to a caller now. We've got David on the line with us in Sullivan. David, hi.
Hello there.
What did you want to bring up, David?
Well, what's been keeping me and making me move from my IT position to IT position, given that I'm a professional of over 10, 15 years, the organization that I'm going to go to work for has to offer tremendous benefits. Now, health is getting to be more and more important to me, and also that big pie in the sky, the retirement possibility, the 401k with a matching contribution, proponent if possible. That's kind of what's drawing me to different places as I look around.
David, thanks a lot for the call and your experience there. So, Dave, one point he raises is if companies want to bring these workers to work for them, maybe they have to up the ante, pay more, better benefits. Is that what it's going to take to attract the people into this line and into their applicant pools?
Yeah, that's something that Brian Hoover from the Wausau Young Professionals Organization really emphasized. Pay is very important. Health benefits are very important. A company that's big enough that can have an on-site healthcare facility that services both the workers and their dependents for nominal fees. Brian Hoover works for a big company in Schofield, and his bottom line is it's called Green Heck Fan Company, and he says one of their big attractions is having that healthcare facility on site where workers and their dependents can come in for minor illnesses. Bring in their kids, and for a nominal fee can get health care. He also emphasizes that these young millennials, these young professionals that work in the IT field, like their time off and flexible hours, a casual dress code, a good work environment is important. And this is something that these young IT workers, young professionals, young millennials look for when they're looking for a job. The caller, David, was talking about healthcare benefits, and clearly in this day and age, that's a key issue.
David, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Carol in Hayward. Carol, hi.
Hi. Yes, my daughter went to school to be in the tech field. She was a CAD operator, and one of the things that drew her to it was when she was still in high school, they had people come and basically talk these kids into, oh, if you go to school, you'll make $60,000 a year if you do this profession. So she went for it, and she did that job for about 12 years and never got over $30,000. And she just got so fed up with it, she finally quit and went back to school to be a nurse now. And she says they promise you everything and give you nothing.
And, Carol, can I ask geographically, where did your daughter work as a CAD operator?
Over in Wausau. She was over in Wausau.
Carol, thanks a lot for that call with that experience. And I've heard that sometimes with colleges, often private colleges, advertising the moon for technical careers, the reality doesn't always pan out. Are salaries as high as people might think they are, Dave?
Well, the State Department of Workforce Development here in Wisconsin puts out a salary sheet, and all I can say is that the caller may be correct. The salary sheets. I'll just cite some of the salaries that are listed. Computer network support specialist, $55,000. Computer user support specialist, $44,000. Computer network architect, $82,000. So it does range from mid 40s to low 80s. I have not picked up on. On what the caller had mentioned about kind of pie-in-the-sky promises about make big money in the tech field, these companies that I've talked to and these educators that I talk to say basically they can't fill the job slots right now. I'm assuming that it's the old law of supply and demand. Those salaries got to be going up if the demand is there and the graduates aren't there to fill them. But I have to admit, I did not run across that kind of experience that the caller cited.
We're talking about information technology careers, a lack of professionals, some are saying, in our state. Dave Daly is with us. He wrote a piece on this topic for the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute. Still time for a call with your experiences at 800-642-1234 as the person hiring or the person being hired. 800-642-1234 is the number. Go next to Mike in Janesville. Mike, hi.
Hi, I'd just like to maybe agree with the last couple callers about showing people the money. If businesses are willing to pay good wages, I think people are going to automatically flock to that job career. And saying it's a shortage kind of doesn't make sense considering it's market forces at play. If gas is $2.50 a gallon and I'm only willing to pay $2 a gallon, then it's not really a shortage.
Mike, thanks for the call. And Dave, you mentioned there's some supply and demand at work here, but maybe part of the problem, I imagine, could be there's demands now, and the supply, if we're working on high school students, might not come up until 5 years later.
Yeah, a couple of people that I talked to mentioned that in Wausau, in central Wisconsin, they've actually formed something called a Central Wisconsin IT Alliance with some of these big software companies. Skyward is one of them, leading the way and putting this alliance together to try to find ways right now to fill that demand. John Corrigal, Vice President for Human Resources at Renaissance Learning in Wisconsin Rapids, noted that, you know, we can attract more high school students into the IT field, but that's not going to help us right now. That's going to be 3, 5, 7 years down the road once they graduate high school and move on to either a 2-year or 4-year college. They are, at least in central Wisconsin, they are business types and educators are scrambling to try to find answers to what is, they say, a shortage right now. So some of these callers talking about the low wages, maybe that's the answer for some of it. You got to start hiking the wages.
We'll go back to our callers. Ava in Oconomowoc is with us now. Ava, hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I just wanted to say my son's going into computer science, and we researched and learned there are 28 computer science programs in the state of Wisconsin UW system, and they do range from mediocre to excellent. Two of the excellent ones that we found included UW Superior, that's graduating people for government security IT, and also UW Stout is it's an excellent computing school. You have to understand, though, that IT means a lot of different things. There's software development, there's security, there's general IT for a business organization. As the other guy said, education, medical. It's such a wide range.
And Ava, don't leave us in suspense. Where's your kid going to school?
Oh, UW Stout.
UW Stout it is. Ava, thanks a lot for that call. So, Dave, as we wrap up, I mean, we've heard about high schools, tech schools, universities. Are companies trying to institute their own training programs on staff where they take savvy young folks and try to make them IT professionals?
Some companies are. Some companies are doing outreach programs with interns, doing outreach programs with local colleges, technical and four-year Bachelor of Arts colleges. It's a range, Rob, from what I can tell. Obviously, not obviously, but many companies, whatever their field, have in-house training programs, and some of these software developers are, in fact, doing that. So I think, Rob, the bottom line is these companies that have a shortage are looking at anything that can fill that shortage.
Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was journalist Dave Daly. He recently explored the issue of the information technology talent shortage in central Wisconsin and beyond for the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute.